spine.
And sprocket.
The SS colonel eased shut the high, heavy door. The portal closed with a hiss and a soft tap. How many trees went into this, he wondered. Lives sacrificed out of the forest to make one of Hitler's castle gates. The Black Eagle emblem of wartime hung at eye level against the carved wood. Colonel Abram Brait imagined the symbol of the Reich to be a spread-winged vulture. That's what he left behind in the briefing room. A death scene. A picking apart, sinew by vessel of Germany. Brait walked several steps into the hall, striding across the same Black Eagle laid in mosaic on the floor. Blood-red banners trickled down the walls. He buttressed his back against one of them and lit a cigarette.
That was the opening paragraph to tonight's topic, which is a book called The Last Citadel by David L. Robbins. And this is a wonderful novel, and this is a novel, it's a work of fiction, about the Battle of Kursk. In July of 1943, 2 million men clashed in the largest battle that mankind has ever seen. And this book was written in about 2003, and David L. Robbins is a still-living author who lives in West Virginia somewhere, I think.
Oh, I didn't realize the book was that recent, actually, when I was reading it.
Yeah.
Not that that would matter what I thought.
No, it's history. It's not going to change what happens very much.
But I'm Dave.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Rich Spilkey.
I'm Mike Lemke.
And there are guests this evening as we discuss The Last Citadel.
Yeah, and I don't know what made me pick this book. I think I just happened to be sort of bumping around on Amazon looking at historical fiction, and this one caught my eye. And I liked the idea that it was fiction, but from what I had read in a few of the reviews, it was also historically accurate.
Plus, it's Eastern Front, which is something at least we don't, Americans, don't get that much of, so that made it interesting to me.
True.
Yeah, that's true. And, I think what I didn't realize going into this was how big and how significant the Battle of Kursk was. As a very casual sort of historical fan of World War II, I didn't know that. I don't think it's one you hear about that much.
Yes,
the man on the street.
I'm much more familiar with, of course, D-Day and the fall of Berlin and
Stalingrad.
All those things. Stalingrad, yeah, speaking of, right, as far as Eastern battles go.
A few years ago, I spent a year or so reading nearly 30 history books on the Eastern Front. And
wow.
So, but this book was really interesting because you got to see how the regular Russian people felt about the whole war and, you know, their approach to it and stuff. So that was interesting.
Mike,
much more, you know, interesting than the history books and the order of battles and all that.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you can do that when you've won the lottery and are independently wealthy. So, is that how you found the time to read 30 books on the Eastern Front, Mike?
I don't watch a lot of reality TV shows. So that
oh,
really,
okay. Yeah,
that frees up a lot of time. Yeah, and so the character opens with the colonel. Brait, is that how we pronounce it?
Yeah, I'd like to ask about that. I was pronouncing it in my head as like Briette, but it's probably Brait.
I was pronouncing it Brait.
So was I, yeah.
Brait, right, okay.
Because E-I in German is usually pronounced I.
I was pronouncing it Smith.
Yeah.
So I was way off, apparently.
You're using the, that's not the official copy of the
or
book.
Or Schmidt,
that's book
since plan. He was German.
Yeah.
And he's a...
Colonel Abram Brait.
Yeah, do you want to...
Yeah, the book opens with Colonel Abram Brait, who is a rather high-up intelligence kind of officer and works closely on occasion with the Führer. But as it also turns out, he is as we find out rather early on in the book, he's a spy. Spying for
the Soviets.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's one of the characters that follows from his viewpoint, and then it introduces...
Louise Vega.
Louise
Vega. Who
I pronounce it Louis.
Yeah, no, I think it's L-U-I-S. How would you say that?
I was thinking Luis because he's a Spaniard who was with the blue Spaniard. A Spaniard.
Yeah. From Espan.
Well, who was with the Blue Division, right? Mm-hmm. Because he gave a little history of the Blue Division, which is why I appreciated this a lot.
I found myself liking him.
Yeah, a lot, actually. Yeah, he was a good character, right.
But I was surprised the SS had foreigners. I didn't realize they did that.
Yes, yeah, they did. I learned that, too, a couple years ago from Holmstrom. The Dutch SS, I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Norwegian SS, I'm like, what are you talking about? And now I have some war posters in my classroom. I teach 8th grade social studies, and one of the posters is join the like Norwegian SS units, you know, in a foreign language, of course, but that's what it's saying. So the Germans recruited other nationalities that fit that Nordic superiority mentality and were willing to fight for that.
There was a point in time, I understand, though, that it was purely Germanic.
Yeah.
But as the war went on and there were fewer and fewer of those folks, I think they definitely expanded their ranks to include others, including other countries.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize that. I had heard that they had, because I also do family history research, so the German, they had to go back in time and prove that they didn't have any undesirables in their family tree for 150 years in order to be in the SS. But then Lewis came along and surprised me. I didn't realize that they...
Yeah, I learned something new, and I liked that about the book, that I kept learning new stuff. I had no idea that the Spaniards were ever even involved that much in the war, and the fact that some of their people were at the SS level was pretty amazing. And he had a very interesting background because he had come from a family of bullfighters, which actually plays pretty large in the storyline as things go along.
That's his worldview.
Yes, right. And then we have the other main characters, one of whom was Dmitry Konstantinovich.
Konstantinovich.
Yeah, that's good. Berko, who is a Russian Cossack of Cossack descent.
Yes, and that plays in well to the story because he's a tank driver.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. The charging tank and the charging horse experience and the dashingness of it all.
Yeah. And he, though he's a little bit older, I think he's around 50 years old or something, and he's been taken into the army and driving tanks, and his son is also in there, Valentin, or Valya, as Dmitry calls him often.
Yeah, and I got a little confused on that. If anyone's going to read this, to prevent people from getting confused, the way they kept going back and forth with the son's name, the Dmitry guy was very clear who that was.
Yeah.
But the way they kept going back and forth between the nickname and the real name, they both start with a V. I thought for a time there was a chapter or two in the middle where I thought those were two different people. And then I came to realize that both of them were the same person.
Ah, yeah.
But there were two names that started with a V. Valya was sort of the nickname. And then what was the other one? Valencia or something, Ravel, I can't remember what it was. There's two that start with a V.
Valentin.
There you go. Valentin and then Valya.
Yes.
Those are the same person.
Yeah, Valentin was his full name and Valya was kind of the short name.
There was a couple of chapters where I was thinking that might have been two people, but I was a little confused and then I realized that it truly was one. That didn't happen to you, apparently?
That didn't happen to me, but and going kind of down that path, one thing I liked about the book was that there were not 100 characters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Really, for a book of this size and for covering a topic this large, there were really about 6 main characters, and it kept really aligned with those 6 characters. So I didn't have that problem with keeping up. I was happy that we didn't have too many people to follow.
Yeah, and Valentin was his son, and then we followed his daughter. Was that Katya? And she was a pilot in the Night Witches, which was a female Soviet flying formation. And just some great stuff about that in here, too. History in here.
Right, and then there's a little bit of romance because you just got to have a little romance in case you want to talk to your wife about this book. And she has romance with a fellow flyer, Leonid.
And he gets captured, ultimately shot down and captured.
By the Germans, and and Katya decides that she needs to go after him.
To rescue him.
To rescue him. And all of this is taking place around these relatively short period weeks around the Battle of Kursk.
Yeah, weeks leading up to Kursk.
Right.
And it is kind of cool the way it bounces back and forth between the different perspectives and how they were seeing it from a different angle.
Yeah, so you have that Spaniard's view, which varies a little differently from some of the Germans' view, the traitorous Germans' view, you know, and then the Russian, Soviet. And even amongst those, you have the fact that Dmitri's son is a commissar. He's like tied in closely with the mm-hmm. party.
Yeah.
So that.
Yeah, he's a Soviet and Dmitri's a Russian.
Yes. Yes. Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, they really distinguish between those things. And
yeah.
Again, maybe at least I'll speak for myself. I didn't appreciate that difference as much as this book kind of made you feel.
At this point, maybe I'll jump in and talk about the historical essence of this. The four of us do some military war gaming as a hobby, and learning about the different ammunition parts. And in this part in Chapter 10, Valentin rested his feet on Dmitri's shoulders, guiding the tank with his heels and toes because he was busy using the intercom for other duty. He was yelling at the loader, Pasha. So did they historically do that, do you know, guiding the... I'm sure the interior of the tanks, it does show the leader guys higher up, and then lower down is the next person, and it's physically possible. I'm sure they did it. He did his research.
Didn't sound nearly as comfortable as Luis's Tiger.
No, that's right. Yeah, the Tiger seemed very spacious.
Yeah,
but the T-34s that Dmitri was driving,
yeah, it
sounded a little
really
tight. But you really got an essence of what it felt like to drive one of these vehicles by reading this.
Well, not just what it felt like, but what you saw, the temperature, the smells.
The smells.
The rickety bouncing around, banging your head and, you know, hurting your other body parts from the jolting around. And
yeah,
it was really remarkable. But I didn't know about the foot tapping, and I don't know if that's true or not.
I didn't either, yeah.
But if that is true, it really makes you appreciate how difficult it was. But then I think Dmitri also the older man, could also drive the tank with some limited vision, it seemed.
Yes.
Without the guy above him.
Yes. Yeah, and this part talks about like this. It says, Pasha struggled on his knees, stripping back the neoprene matting that lay across the floor bins, digging down in them for the correct shells. This time, Valya wanted solid-shot, armor-piercing rounds. Somehow, Pasha had managed to grapple from the floor the wrong ammo, a heat shell, H-E-A-T, high-explosive anti-tank round, and the T-34 carried 77 rounds, 19 of armor-piercing, 53 of high-explosive, and 5 of anti-personnel. Only 9 of these rounds were easily accessible on racks located left and right on the turret wall. Once those shells were expended, the loader had to root around under the floor mat into the 8 storage bins beneath their feet. When the tank was moving at full speed, swaying and hopping the way it was now, the loader's job was very difficult. Kind of touches on what we were just saying, the detail of the interior and the bumpy ride.
But it really makes you appreciate the refueling, the restocking of ammo. That's the kind of thing that in a war game you don't really worry about.
Right.
Right.
Right. And it's something that's never shown. I've never seen it in movies. I mean, we've seen some movies about tanks. Now, we mentioned Fury when we were talking before the show, which I have not seen. So I don't know if that does a good job of portraying what it's like to be in a tank. But in the few other movies that have been about tanks, and I'm thinking of Sahara with Humphrey Bogart, we never get to see the inside of the tank at all. And there were limitations in those days. You just couldn't get a camera inside of a tank. It was too big. It was too impractical. So we never really get the sense of what it's like being in there. But we definitely now we do with this.
And for folks that don't, you know, war game the way we do, they definitely made a very strong point that was not too technical, but also interesting, I think, to someone who's not familiar, about the side armor being thinner than the front armor and the turret armor being sloped and the advantages of having sloped turret armor and the different types of ammunition and the effects they have on, you know, the armor piercing, the high explosive anti-tank, the high explosive anti-personnel. Mm-hmm. And so without getting too technical, they made you really understand that all the tactics are really all about positioning and maneuvering and using the right ammo at the right time. And things like that.
And this is Dmitri describing the high explosive anti-tank. When this hits, the shell ignites, and he drew a finger through the center of the diamond toward the tip, and it makes a jet of molten metal and super hot gases that will burn a hole through the armor. The crew inside is blinded in the first split second. then everything inside the tank is set on fire. So I remember when I first learned about that kind of armor piercing, that it could actually hit, and then molten metal comes out of it, superheated, and burning a hole through the armor.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, that amazes me.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting, the T-34 with the sloped, they couldn't afford or didn't want to add more armor like the Germans did with the Tigers, but then they just sloped it in that. I don't know if shells bounce off the slope?
It helps deflect. Oh, I don't remember if it was described
there
in the book.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they were actually critical. The Russians were actually critical a little bit of the Tiger, even though they feared it, because it just was just a big hunk of metal. They didn't even bother
sloping the armor.
They just put just heaps of
steel,
apparently.
Heaps of steel, yeah.
And they were kind of critical of that they were, you know, inefficient that way. But that actually slowed down the vehicle, and the engine just couldn't be powerful enough to go much faster because it had so much weight, and they made that point. Which is true in the wargaming world, too. That vehicle is very good on defense, but is kind of slow on the attack. And that was interesting. I also like the way they had the turret speed come into play.
Yes.
And again, for those of us who wargame, turret speed sometimes is important.
How quickly the turret can turn.
Yes.
Traverse.
Yes, well said.
And the different methods, whether it's a motorized or hand crank that actually turns the turret. So I was wondering about this because all four of us are war gamers, and a particular war game that we play is very detailed, and so we really appreciated the amount of detail that David Robbins went into when he was describing how the tanks are assembled and how they travel and how they fight and how they do in battle and all this kind of thing. It was amazing to us because we saw a lot of detail and stuff that comes forward for us from our wargaming. But for somebody who is not a wargamer... Yeah. Is this too much?
None of us would know.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
I would hope not. I would hope that they would appreciate the fine points of what these folks were dealing with and what they were confronting and the problems they had to overcome and the issues they had to deal with and the coordination it took.
I would guess David Robbins, maybe I'm wrong, but he's maybe not a war gamer, but he just did an incredible amount of research and he felt it was interesting enough to... You know, let's put it in the story.
Fascinating history in and of itself. And I think he does the same treatment also to other things in the book, like the landscape, the villages. Mm-hmm. So it's all there at that level. I think we just probably noticed that less because of our specific interests.
Right.
Oh, and Kursk is the biggest tank battle in history. So you've got to go into the
tank stuff.
Tank details. Yeah.
Yeah. So the storyline then, the girl was shot down. No. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Katya gets shot down while she's out looking for her boyfriend, Leonid.
Who was shot down before.
And she gets picked up by a partisan group and joins the partisans for a while. They're a little bit suspicious of her because she's a woman and because she's a witch, a fighter, a bomber pilot.
Yeah, and not from their local area.
Yeah.
That's the nickname they have for the women.
Right.
Pilots.
They call them the Night Witches.
And he's explained the Germans call them, the girls, the Night Witches. And that's kind of where it came from.
Right. So she's off looking for her boyfriend. In the meantime, Luis, who has been wounded, he was wounded earlier in the war.
Previous.
And so he's a little bit infirm.
Yes.
But still very eager to get into battle and prove himself. I thought what was really interesting about this is each of the people in the book... have very specific reasons of why they're fighting the battle and the fighting the war. And interestingly, none of them were just patriotic Germans.
Right, yeah.
For the people that were on the German side, they were not patriotic Germans. And even the Russians were not patriotic Soviets. This guy, Dmitry, was a Cossack and very proud of his Cossack heritage.
Well, his son, Valya, was more
do-it-for-the-party kind
of guy.
Yeah,
but he might have been the only one.
Yeah, he was probably the only one.
Yeah,
the other ones were so young, they didn't really know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Two new loaders that they got on the tank.
But Luis was very eager to get back into battle, and so he worked his way sort of to the front, where into the command post, where he was taking sort of a command position, overall view, but then he was very eager to actually get in the battle, and that's where we get to the... I would say to the meat of the book, which was tank battling. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I thought the whole partisan bit.
That was really interesting.
I think he did it in equal portions, actually.
Because yes, that's right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
The two characters cross, they cross paths in the partisan part of the story, too.
Bright comes...
Bright, yeah.
Yeah, Bright ends up crossing paths with the partisans and... Kasha? Yeah, and then Luis crosses paths with
Katya.
With Katya?
No, not with Katya.
No, with the tank. I mean, the Russian...
Yeah, Luis fights Dmitri.
Dmitri
and his group, whole group.
Yeah, you could see that coming.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming.
Really? I mean, you knew eventually they were going
to
meet.
I
wonder if they're going to face off. Well, maybe I did, but...
I actually didn't see it coming either.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that part I did feel like I could see coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it did catch me a little.
I mean, you knew it was going to come down to those two. I mean, it just seemed like, how could it not?
Yeah, it should have.
I think I just felt like it would be too contrived for these two main characters to actually meet, and yet that's really where it made the most sense. And here was a great battle between Dmitri, who was like a bull.
Yes, charging
and
around.
And Luis, who was like a matador, and charging around with their tanks.
You know, the face and body that I was picturing for Dmitri, you guys may laugh at, but I was picturing, what's that guy's name? He's in some of the World War II movies back in the day. Kind of like a Kojak kind of guy. Bald and, you know, about 50, like you're saying.
Telly Savalas?
Yeah, kind of like a guy like that. That's who I was envisioning for Dmitri. No? Mm-hmm. What do you think? No?
Yeah, I was thinking more of somebody like Topol. From Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's a good
one,
too.
I was thinking more like
Stocky,
him.
Though.
Yeah, Stocky.
Yeah, Stocky.
Okay.
The one character that I had a hard time just even believing, the rest of them were very believable, but the Colonel Abram Breit or Bright, that guy, I couldn't relate to him being a spy. Really? That was a hard one for me to...
Oh, I had no problem with it. I think the way he described his thoughts about Germany, even from the opening part we heard read there at the beginning, he saw the eagle as a vulture, or a picking apart of Germany, what was going on with Hitler, and the guys were just destroying Germany. Mm-hmm. And I think Robbins did a good job of showing us his view that he felt he was saving Germany by
very
being
patriotic
the
motives, not so much wanting the Russians to or the Soviets to win, but saving Germany from itself, basically.
Yeah, and then you have, of course, historically, of course, right, Rommel implicated in the assassination plot, the guys that did the actual bombing against Hitler. Mm-hmm. And so I really saw him as one of those guys, selling out for that reason.
I understand that was his rationale, but I still had a hard time relating to that character.
I'll agree with you there. I didn't really get as much of a sense of what was driving him internally. I know we're shown very specifically that he loved art, and whenever there were scenes looking out at things, he was looking at it from an artistic point of view, just from the way David Robbins was describing colors and things like that when he was talking about Bright. It was very artistic sounding, so I got that part. But I didn't really see his motivation as a German.
Let me read this part here from the book. The bomber revved and rumbled to the runway. The plane shook its rivets and sprinted ahead, lifting off. Bright gazed out his window over the wing at Russia, letting go. He felt no allegiance to this land he was helping, this backward, unfinished place. He was a German, and what he was doing, he did for Germany. Russia was nothing but a tool for the changes he and the others saw must come about. Bright sat back, listening to the droning, rising plane. He lit his first cigarette in over an hour. The bomber gained altitude. The country below became immense, tinged with the coming dusk. Bright looked away. It was too much to think that he was affecting all this to a thousand horizons.
Hmm. Yeah.
So there.
I did think it was a little bit over the top, though, at the end when they had...
Wait, are we going to the end?
Well, when they had him shoot the guy, the German officer that wouldn't let the fire department put the fire out of the German house. That elevated him to like sainthood, and that was too much for me.
I forgot that part. Can you refresh my mind?
It's towards the end.
He ended
towards
up back. End, yeah. He ended up back in Germany. Okay, he was with the partisans.
Yeah.
Then he was with back in Germany.
Even the partisans didn't believe that he was really on their side.
No, no. But well, then, I no, you wouldn't.
He
you
had
know.
Him do yeah. what to the fire?
At the
fire.
Very. Yeah. The last Germany's scene burning. With him. There's fires being said, and there's a house on fire.
There's a house on fire in Berlin after the bombing.
And he asked the officer in charge why you're not watering, why you're not putting water on the house to put the fire out. And he said because Jews are living there, and he ordered him to do it, and he wouldn't do it. And so he shot him.
Oh, okay, right.
Shot him in the arm or whatever.
Yeah, shot him in the shoulder, and the guy went down, and then he got up again, just like they do in the movies. Can you really do that after you get shot in the shoulder? Can you stand up again?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I felt like Bright was. I felt like.
Did it happen to you?
Yeah.
Oh.
You're okay with it?
Yeah, several times. I go to Chicago a lot.
Yeah.
But I felt like that elevated him to like sainthood, and it was just too much for me.
Yeah, little bit. I had little problems here and there in the book.
Here's one part you had problems with.
Yeah, read that part. Dave.
Anna lost her balance in a few wild steps. This is Anna, the Night Witch. Wait, I thought her name was
Katya, but Anna was her co-pilot. Anna was Katya's co-pilot.
Right. And anyway, Katya tried to scramble out. Oh, no, Anna was her horse. Sorry. Anna was the horse named after her co-pilot.
Yes,
right.
Okay.
At this point.
The horse wasn't the co-pilot.
Anna lost her balance, the horse, in a few wild steps and crumbled over, hitting the ground on top of her. Katya tried to scramble out, but her legs were trapped. The weight was too much. Katya couldn't even kick at the horse. Anna convulsed, screaming, grinding Katya into the black dirt. Katya cringed at the agony of the shuddering animal across her thighs and ankles, but couldn't make a sound, and the German patrol might hear her. She gritted her teeth and blew slow breaths. The patrol had shut off their flashlights at the blast and threw the red haze in her eyes. And the injured horse's terrified breathing, she no longer knew where the Germans were. Struggling to sit up, she looked over Anna's heaving side. The horse had been ripped open at the abdomen. Intestines spilled on the ground and lapped across her trembling shoulder and flank. The moon stole the color of Anna's workings. Her guts were gray and pulsing. Blood ran black. Tears ran down Katya's face. Her horse was in agony. The report of the explosion had faded away now, and Anna's cries would bring the guards right to where Katya and she lay. They put a rifle to Anna's head to finish the poor beast, and then do the same for Katya, the trapped partisan. But, I mean, this description I thought was just crazy. Anna's panicked eye, unblinking and beseeching. You are the rider. You can lead us away from this. That blew my mind.
Yeah, I think
the
that's
horse
really good.
Looking up, thinking, you're the rider. Save us from this. I mean, that just, you can tell I kind of love that, don't I?
Yes, you did.
That is good. Well, what was your issue with that?
As it goes on a little bit, it turns, Katya sacrifice, well, Anna is about to die anyway. The horse is in agony. And so she sort of guts, she kills Anna and then sort of guts the horse and rubs the guts all over herself so that when the German squad walks by, they won't notice that she's alive. She uses it for camouflage.
They'll think that she's dead.
She rubs the gore all over herself. And I just felt that was a little over the top. And I told Dave, and he said, oh, I love that scene.
I must be the easy guy here.
Yeah.
I liked it, too. I thought the Katya young lady character was awesome.
Yeah.
She really made you understand.
She made the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, just... going back even to be a woman pilot and not get the respect of the male pilots and to have the dangerous jobs. It also makes you realize how much the Russians really did use women compared to a lot of the other countries that didn't utilize women to the degree that the Russians did.
Yeah.
And, but even then moving forward to this specific scene, she was a great horse rider because her father was a Cossack and taught her how to ride a horse. And she used those skills not only as a pilot, but then, as a, when she got saved by the partisans, then she became one of them for a time.
Yes.
And then she had to use her horsemanship skills.
Yeah.
And they were very impressed with how good she was.
And then she had to use the whole horse.
Yes.
To save herself.
Yeah. She earned their respect in that. It's true. It was after that that they really took her in as one of their own.
Right.
After that whole incident.
Yeah. And then Breida's, of course, shot down, and I thought I'd read this part. We're just talking about his writing. I think I was trying to zero in on here. He describes the guns chattering, and Bright believed he could make out the sizzle of the rounds and the metal patter of their strikes. The smoking track of the bomber's flight bent downward. The plane was riddled and killed. It whined, remorseful and beaten, then crashed into a proud fireball.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
This beaten plane going down, I'm dead, and then this proud fireball.
Good sound effect.
Thank you.
I did not understand, maybe you guys can help me, there was a spy amongst the partisans, so the opposite side of things. Yeah. I didn't quite understand who that was and how he was related.
The Germans were holding his wife hostage, and they ended up being together at the final scene where you see that guy.
Yes.
So
he was the twin brother.
Yeah.
To one of the elders who was in the partisans. And it was revealed, yes, that his wife, it did unfold kind of in a confusing way, I thought, a little bit, that whole scene where the partisans had gone to this village where they knew that Leonid was being held and Katya was to rescue him. Mm-hmm. And they moved into that. And that whole sequence, to me, got a little bit confusing as to what was going on, because Robbins got in very detailed as to exactly how people were moving and standing as they went into some combat and some fighting and stuff. And it was introduced rather passé, I think, that this person's wife was being held and forcing this guy to reveal information to the Germans. So... Yeah, I was confused with that.
It sort of was revealed at an awkward time, or a time you didn't expect that part of it to be resolved.
Yes.
Then Leonid thing was resolved, and then that was resolved right on the heels of that. And
yes.
It kind of was a little
confusing.
But
they showed no mercy or no sympathy for that situation, it seemed.
No.
No, they didn't. Germans?
The partisans, killed him, right?
Yeah.
They showed him no mercy.
Yeah, one thing I learned was that they were, when they went into the village and demanded the, fit males to come out of the Soviet villages and were willing to kill to make them.
The villagers were getting taken advantage of by both sides.
Right,
the villagers
were
just innocent bystanders being manipulated by both sides.
Yeah. The partisans probably, and they probably were that tough, but the scene where Katya's going to knife the guy, right? I thought that was really, really well done.
Yes.
I like that horse I was really struggling with as it was dying. I could feel it. And then she put the food in the bread, or the knife in the bread,
In the bread, yes.
And goes up to the German guy and is like, how'd they get in there? Oh, what was the German talking to?
They're
posing as captives or something?
No, I think they were posing to say they were just bringing some bread for the prisoner.
Oh, and
they
were local helping Soviets instead of like partisan fighters? Yeah. Yeah, and she comes in and then she offers him this bread and then pulls this dagger out. And if I can share this part, because I liked it so much. Katya plunged the dagger deep above a pocket on the tunic. The German's hands tried to rise, but Philip pinned his arms at the elbows. Philip was the Russian guy, right?
Yeah.
The haft of the knife shook with the violence of the guard's reaction. The man's throat was plugged by a swallow of bread. He choked a cry out, and then the knife handle jerked loose from her grip. She was shocked by this because she had thought she'd held it with all her might. She believed she'd stabbed the blade into the man's working heart as hard as she could, but the German still stood, wrestling in Philip's old grasp. He did not go down. The knife stuck in his chest, not dead. He made another strangled cry, bucking in Philip's arms, twisting back and forth, left and right. Philip strained to hold him. Katya followed the handle with seeking and urgent hands to catch it and draw it out, to shove it in again, but to cut the man's throat if she had to, but Philip could not hold him still, and the haft evaded her. She struggled at the guard's chest to grab the knife and could not. The guard coughed out a gob of bread and the wad hit Katya. He screamed. One of his hands broke from Philip's grip, clenched. He fumbled to lift the machine pistol. The knife handle, slick with blood, slipped through her fingers again. Where was Joseph? Where were the others? Panic jettisoned into her blood. Philip lost his grasp. The guard reeled back a step from her, knocking over the chair. Philip tried hard to control the frenzied guard, but was thrown off, and the soldier had both hands on his gun now. The knife protruded from his chest like the key to a mad wind-up doll.
Oh.
Remember that line?
Yeah.
That's a good line.
That's a good line. I thought that I really liked that part of the scene. It reminded me of the Alfred Hitchcock movie, and I don't recall the title, but it's with Paul Newman. And there's one scene where Paul Newman and I believe the woman that plays his wife in the movie are trying to kill somebody. And Hitchcock wanted to show how really hard it is to kill somebody. And they were like going at him with a shovel and trying. They eventually stuck his head in the oven and turned the gas on, you know, and finally gassed him to death. But what you think is going to be a nice quick thing actually turns into this horrifying.
It is horrifying.
Yeah. This horrifying struggle.
Yeah.
It's not like what it is oftentimes when you see in the movies.
Yeah, where exactly it's just a little, right. I thought
little clean little thing and they're gone.
Really nice job. I mean, it's probably easy to say, oh, the partisan heroes easily stabbed the Germans and won, you know, than to suddenly have it go bad.
Yeah. They really make you feel like you're there, like you're feeling these feelings, and every second is another thought, you know, when you're perspiring and you're nervous and, you know, the seconds just seem like, you know, hours in the preceding moments before you leap into action. You're afraid, you're nervous, you know, you feel that. You feel as if you're the person.
Heart pounding kind of tension.
And I felt like that was, I felt for a book that covered such a large topic, it was very personal. We got really personal with all of the characters. We were in their skin, feeling what they feel, smelling what they smelled. And if I could compare it, and for some reason I kept thinking of Hunt for Red October. I don't know if anybody read that.
No.
Tom Clancy, one of his first books, which was very, very exciting, but 100 characters and nothing personal. Still a great book, but very, very different from this, because this one takes a totally different view of it and making it all very personal.
Yeah, Hunt for Red October was focused on the technology and the chase.
Yes.
And the big picture,
right?
The Cold War, whereas this, it really got down into these people's lives, and
which surprised me. I wasn't expecting that when I picked this up, so it was a nice surprise.
I also liked the part where they really had even the details of how the trenches were dug, with the civilians and how hard they had to work. And it goes back to the history of how the Russians just prepared like nobody's business for this attack, and they knew it was coming for months, and they just had unbelievable civilian and military preparations to dig trenches and barricades. And
Dmitry did not know the numbers, and he did not care. It was enough that right in front of him, perhaps 10 miles across on this clear day, crammed on this flat tableland of central Russia, from the Oboyan Road west past the Pena River, was the greatest concentration of rifles, tanks, anti-tank guns, artillery, mines, barbed wire, blockhouses, and obstacles assembled in the entire war. Over 40,000 anti-tank and anti-personnel mines had been laid in the 10-mile front of his 6th Guards. That was more than a mine per foot. Over 1 million mines across the whole of the Kursk salient. The explosives lay during the spring in bare fields that were now overgrown with maize, wheat, mustard, sunflowers, and steppe grasses to make the mines almost impossible to detect. The defense works had arisen immense and deep. He'd driven his T-34 past these positions, called pack fronts, during weeks of drills and scrambles. 6th Guards alone manned 2 belts in depths up to 10 miles and widths to 20. And there were 13 more Soviet armies with defenses just as solid throughout the Kursk Bulge. With 7 extra armies held in reserve, there were 8 defensive belts in all, the first 3 of which were gargantuan, and every one of them was connected by trenches. There must have been 1,000 miles of trenches dug on 6th Guards front alone. When the Germans finally do attack, they'll have to wade through more than hell. Hell will be just their front door.
Lines and lines and lines of defense. It made it seem like the Germans were just unwise to attack. And the Germans were attacking with inferior numbers. Now, maybe their tanks were a little better. Maybe their infantry was a little bit better trained. But you just can't go. You can't be on the attack. I mean, for any of us that war game.
Not against those,
you know, you
defenses.
Really can't. I mean, yeah, the Tiger tank was awesome, but it was slow and clunky. And there were just so many T-34s, which were a very good tank, and some people think that was the best tank of the war, arguably, but it was definitely very good. And the German Mark IVs were probably about the equivalent of the T-34s, and you know, you could argue that too, but roughly. But you just, they were outnumbered, like what, 2-3 to 1?
Yeah, they. I didn't know they had held up on the Kursk battle and Hitler losing some initiative there to wait for these tigers to be brought to the battlefield, which is how Luis got there, right?
Yeah.
Escorting the tigers,
yeah.
On the trains, and then fighting the partisans off, too, on the trains. They attacked the trains, which is where Akacha's horse died in the explosions by the train tracks. And, I didn't realize they had so few of the tigers for this battle, right? Wasn't it just
it was
20 or like 50 or something?
I don't remember the number, but it was,
small.
A small amount.
Very small percentage, yeah.
But they were tough.
But they did make a breakthrough on the south, right? They got through all of the defense lines, the two SS groups.
Historically, yes.
Mm-hmm. So somehow,
yeah.
North got stalled away.
It just made you realize, though, how can you beat the Russians? Period. And so many people.
Well, you can beat them at chess if you have
at chess.
Have Bobby Fischer.
There you go.
Or Deep Blue.
Okay.
Deep Blue, yeah.
That would have saved everybody a lot of extra.
Well, it's the scene from All Quiet on the Western Front. Why don't they just? There's a great scene in All Quiet. We should do that on this show, where they're sitting around the German guys going, "Well, what are we fighting again for?" I think some guy got mad at some other guy in France, and why don't the generals just get in a ring in their underwear? And two guys go at it, and then that country can have its way. I don't hate the French people. How did I get in this? It was one of those really cool moments. Mm-hmm. It's kind of classic war concept, of the exhausted troops forgetting the whole reason for any of the
It just makes you realize no matter how much heroism the Germans might display, you just can't overcome the numbers and the
quantities.
You just can't.
Yeah.
Heroism only can take you so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do have this little bit about coming in there right with the works that were described here. And Dmitri again, right, the T-34 tank guy. Around them was the coming battle. On all sides of the battle was the war. And beyond the war was the world and the shape it would take. On and on it spun into history and eternity and oblivion. It all pivoted around him, Dmitri, and his cigarette. What'd you think about it? I guess the world does kind of pivot around us, each individual.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. And then it gets into the politics. This was what Valentin couldn't take from him, what the communists could not dominate, this, his spirit. Right? And then the Stuka fighters come sweeping in.
Yeah.
Right at that moment. So you get that concept. I thought the book did an interesting job of showing that. Like you said, he's a Russian versus a Soviet,
Yeah.
And the communist, and he just despised them, Dmitri, He knew what their game was all about.
And the relationship between the son and the father is complex.
Yes.
And they really don't talk about the son's feelings about the dad.
Now, that's true.
But the dad really struggles with the relationship with the son, and he has reflection about it that's, shared in the book. And you can really feel for the dad. He doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's a lot going on there, and not the least of which is that the son gets to a point where he is not only the symbolic leader, because he is the father's superior officer, but also the point when Dmitri just realizes it happens to everybody. It happens to every father when their son finally eclipses them. And when the father has to sort of give in and say, you're in charge now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in charge anymore. I'm old.
Yeah.
I'm letting it go.
Yeah,
and it's very, very difficult for Dmitri, but he does come to that point.
But he didn't appreciate the values that his son had adopted vis-a-vis the Soviets.
Right.
As opposed to his, so that was hard for him to accept that his son had eclipsed him, was better than him, was a superior officer, and yet had gone a totally different path.
Yeah, had let his Cossack background take a back seat.
Yeah.
So the book sort of ends up, the climax of the book is this tank battle.
In the sunflower field.
When we were playing last week, and you were running your tanks through the field, I wanted to say, oh yes. This reminds me of the sunflower. Yeah. If you hadn't read that part
that's
yet.
Right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So what did you think of that, the final scene, that final battle,
nice.
Rich?
Well, I liked it. It was very exciting and interesting, and the way it all came together with the one tank being destroyed but not completely, and then getting into the other tank that was destroyed from the gun's point of view but not from the vehicular point of view, and how they combine their efforts together to win without actually talking to each other. Mm-hmm. What I didn't like was at the very, very end, where the son was just sort of, in my mind, kind of arbitrarily, and he died in Berlin a few months later. It just sort of like...
Oh, did he say that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, see, I forgot it already.
Post-war.
Yeah, so the only person who survives is Katya, the woman, the daughter.
Right.
And she marries the pilot that she was in love with, and they are married, and they have a child. But then her father, you know, dies in this battle, and the brother doesn't die in the battle, but then they just sort of write him off like, well, he died a little while later in the Battle of Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's just abrupt.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I did think that was kind of odd. And I'm very sensitive.
He was treating it as a postscript thing, wasn't he? Like,
yeah, a little bit.
So
a little bit,
maybe not necessary. Maybe
I think they could have let him live with the sister and just have him be part of the. I don't think they had to kill him off.
Yeah,
whatever. I'm quibbling. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah,
net, but that's just a, it's a quibble.
That's what we're here to do.
It's a quibble.
Yeah. That's what we're.
But being the war gamers, the final scene, the battle is fantastic with the turret going the wrong way, and that's what cost them their lives.
Yes.
Yeah, what was it again?
The turret couldn't move because Dimitri's gun was blocking his gun.
Oh.
So in order to move it, he couldn't move the way he wanted to. That would have been
correct.
All the way around and then show his reverse side backside of the.
That's correct, to the other tank in the band.
But they needed, and that's when the shot was taken.
But they needed a turret hit.
Yes.
You need a turret hit,
which is what a wargamer would, which is a less than 50-50 chance.
Yes.
So, see, you guys were all into that part. I was into this part with the flowers here. The flowers looked shocked to be hit like this. They flung out their leaves, turned their heads at the last moment, and fell looking into his eyes. We're innocent. Why do you do this? Crushed.
I appreciate the flowers' perspective.
You know,
that's beautiful.
And Jeff was referring to this art bit, too. And in the ending here, we have Bright is back in Germany, right? Yeah. Successfully saving the Reich from the Nazis and or Germany from the Nazis. His eyes on three panels. He's back at that museum.
Yeah.
Gauguin, side by side with Van Gogh, and Degas. The Impressionist, again, humanity, emotion, randomness, illogic, on the canvas, in the streets, on the battlefield, on the rectangular pages of history, and there is in the end nothing but the squiggles of the human hand.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy can write.
He's
going from this massively fantastic historical account with realism and the characters that I think we're all saying we kind of enjoyed a lot, and then to do that with the art and to do that to the poor sunflowers.
I like the sunflower descriptions and looking at the sunflowers.
The tank was crushing them down. And
it was cool.
Yeah.
You can
picture it. Oh, yeah.
You can see them flipping and being torn up as they're fighting through that.
However, I must point out, in the games we play, there are rules about when an AFE can enter another AFE's location. And I'm not sure all those rules were being followed.
And there's also rules about sunflowers.
Maybe we should write David Robbins and just point him to the rules section of the game we play.
I'm not saying all the rules were followed to the letter. Yeah. I'm just saying perhaps not. Yeah.
All in all, though, I would say this is a very good book, highly recommended, at least by me.
I would highly recommend this book.
For anybody that likes a book that's exciting and historical and
is fiction, and so it's got the storyline. At first, I thought we were looking at just a historical book, like I've been getting used to reading nonfiction. So then I'm like, oh, this is be a good break for me to go back to stuff like this, and I really did enjoy it. So nice pick.
Yeah, I'm gonna maybe not give it quite that high of a rating. I'm gonna, a good book. I liked it. I'm glad I read it. I would recommend it, but I'm not quite maybe as enthusiastic. I'll give it like a B+, I guess, if I were to give it. Good, but not. I didn't like love it to death, but I liked it.
Okay, so don't buy it and put it on your shelf. Get it at the library.
Sure, we'll go with that.
No, buy it.
You could buy mine. We want you David Robbins. You could buy my copy.
I think you should buy it and then give it away.
Buy my copy.
I checked it out of the library.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Jeff and I bought copies.
Yes, I have a...
Support your favorite artists.
I'll give this away on one of our shows, this very copy, because it's in pristine condition. I actually bought the book in paper, and I also bought it on Kindle, and I ended up reading it on the Kindle.
So, I'll give you my copy, then you can give it away as well.
Okay, great.
No one would want my copy. I bought it used.
No, that looks kind of used, yeah.
What's your final ranking on it, Mike?
Well, I was going to say B+. I mean, I thought I liked it. I liked it well enough to read another of his books, The Drive to Berlin. So,
it says author of War of the Rats.
See, my library doesn't have that, so I might have to buy that one. Yeah. That's a Stalingrad one. Stalingrad. So, yeah,
that's Stalingrad.
Definitely want to read that, too.
Did you not read the following book? There's a wee bit of an introduction to his next book, which is Liberation Road, which is about the fall of Berlin, perhaps.
June 11, 1944. B+5.
No,
you didn't read that one. Okay.
No, I read one called either the Drive to Berlin or the Road to Berlin.
Okay.
And Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin are in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Along with regular people like this book.
How on earth did they fit them into a book? They're all dead. Number one.
That's
number
it. Makes two. It easier.
What, do you have to compress them like press flowers?
Maybe just their ashes.
Fit them in the book. It's ridiculous.
All right, but that wraps it up for The Last Citadel. Thanks, David Robbins, for writing the book. And thank you all, Rich.
And thanks, Mike for coming tonight.
Jeff.
My pleasure.
That's me. And we'll see you next time.
Spine.
And sprocket.